So, as we look at this handout some more for the tape here, you'll notice there's a river that runs down the west side, the left side there of the city. The light gray solid line is where the wall of the city of Rome was. The darker black dotted line around it is the where the people lived, who that's how far the city had expanded outside of those walls. On this map, it looks very small. 1 to 2 million people, when Paul wrote to this church in Rome, 1 to 2 million people lived inside that black dotted line. Some inside the walls, some outside the walls. There's one other thing. Look at on the far left-hand side. There's between the river and the dotted line, there's this little box in there called the Jewish Quarter. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But at this period of time, all of the Jewish people lived in that settlement, literally on the other side of the tracks, on the other side of the river, separated from everybody else. You know, I really don't. That's a good question. I don't know how. It's big enough to hold 1 to 2 million people. Yeah. To give you some idea, if you took everything, all the people who live between Visalia and Chowchilla, you're looking at roughly 1.3 million people. Okay? So it was bigger than that area in terms of population. But I have to tell you, too, it was very dense. We'll talk about that in a second, how dense it was. But it was extremely dense.
It's only 16 square miles.
Okay. Not very big.
With 2 million people.
Yep. That's dense. Okay. Thank you very much.
That's Wikipedia, so take it for what it's worth. It may not be accurate.
That's okay. On page 2 of your notes there, the ancient history of ancient Rome, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but a little bit will be helpful to set up some things. First of all, letter A, the development of Rome as a republic, which happened, began in about 508, 509, 508 BC. It goes in the dots there from the monarchy to a republic for about 250 years leading up to 509, 508, it was a monarchy, but the monarchy, the kingship, was getting more corrupt, and it was weakening more and more. The city of Rome at this point, and I'm going to talk a lot about that, and there's a reason for that. The city of Rome during this period of time was a small city-state. It was about where the city of Rome is right now. That was the city-state. It was its own country, so to speak. Had its own king, its own government. It's took care of itself. It did trade with the world. It did not have a country that it reported to. There was no one greater than it that it reported to. And Italy and Greece were just peppered with these city-states. And Rome happened to be one of the larger ones, but it was diminishing and losing power by the time we get to 509, 508 BC. At that point in time, it was relatively small when it becomes a republic. A republic basically means they did away with the monarchy, and it is ruled, it is self-ruled. The people said, let's rule ourselves. Let's take care of ourselves. I'm oversimplifying, but that's basically what it was. Well, you can't have even 250,000 people all get together by committee and determine laws and enforce them. You just can't do that. So what do you do? Well, they elected representatives. They voted on representatives who would be senators. And the Senate would get together, and they would pass the laws. They would work with the army to enforce the laws. Of the land. They would work to build trade with other cities and other countries and expand so that, and because of that, this city-state of Rome grew phenomenally. It had dwindled in the previous 250 years, but for the first 200 years of the Republic, it just exploded. And in fact, the entire peninsula of Italy became the city-state of Rome. It controlled all of Italy in the next 200 years. So it had grown from being one city-state to basically controlling that entire peninsula and everything in it. Well, when you grow and develop like that, it has an impact upon other countries. All of a sudden, they were very successful, and that became, in one way, a threat to other countries because of their success. They were having a lot of influence on the Mediterranean Sea. They were using the sea to make trade with countries all over the Mediterranean, from Northern Africa, Israel, Asia. They were making trade with all of these. They were growing and expanding. They were taking business away from other countries because they were being more efficient and more effective at it. So they became a threat in that sense. And some of the countries wanted to get rid of them. So after that first couple of hundred years of growth, there are a couple of major wars. They are attacked. They're attacked by Carthage in northern Africa. They send their ships, their navy up to attack them, and they defeat Carthage. Well, when they defeat Carthage, all of a sudden they control Carthage. And they bring people back as slaves to the city-state of Rome, and who can help them do things, and they don't have to pay them. They own them. They get a lot of wealth from Carthage that now then they can bring back to the city-state of Rome and build their city and make it even better. Pretty nice. They never thought about that. That was never part of their culture before, was to be a warring country that would go out and conquer other countries. They had expanded mainly through commerce and influence and effectiveness and an attractiveness to this republic idea, which was different than a monarchy. Then there is another war that takes place from Macedonia, from the Greeks. There is another war that takes place during this period of time, during this next 150 years after those first 200 years. And same thing happens. They take control of Greece, and northern Greece particularly, and they get slaves. They get bounty from it. They get control of a lot more of the Mediterranean Sea. Now they've got more ports to work from and all kinds of things.
Is this pre-Augustus, or are we talking
pre-Augustus? Pre-Augustus, yeah. This by about 150 BC, these two wars have taken place, and that's happened. So the first 200 years of Republic, from around 500 to 300, we have this tremendous expansion taking up the entire peninsula of Italy, what's modern-day Italy. The next 150 years, these two major wars happen, and the city-state of Rome is expanding beyond its borders. It has campuses, so to speak, at other places on the Mediterranean, places where it can go, and it controls. I don't know how many of you have ever, probably some of you have, lived in the country, had dogs and chickens and all those kind of things. Part of my growing up years, I lived in the country, and I had a dog. And we raised chickens every year, and then we would butcher the chickens and freeze them and eat chicken all year. But our dog, my dog, I found him one day chasing a chicken and killing it. And there's something that happens to a dog when it gets the taste of fresh blood. It becomes insatiable. It wants it more and more and more. And most of those dogs have to be put down, because they're going to kill things to be able to taste fresh blood. That's what happened to the city-state of Rome. They got this taste of blood from war. Neither one of the wars they instigated, but they got the taste of the bounty, the benefits of war, and how it could make their lives better ultimately. And all of a sudden, they switched from being a country that defended itself when attacked to becoming an empire that attacked and went out and conquered other countries. And that's why when we get to Augustus, we see him expanding so much, because now then they are a nation who want to control other countries, and they're on the offensive now, not just the defensive. Letter B, Julius Caesar from 48 to 44 BC. What Julius Caesar does is he conquers some of those countries around him. He's on the offensive. He is very effective. He's very powerful, and he creates a lot of fear. And he becomes, for all practical purposes, a dictator in a republic. What had made the city-state of Rome flourish and grow from back when? It was a republic. The people had control, not a monarchy. But he, for all practical purposes, made himself a dictator, and in those 4 to 5 years, and the Senate got very uneasy about it. And someone who was very close to him, Brutus, along with a number of other senators, assassinated Julius Caesar. And so he died in 44 BC, but not before he had adopted, I believe it was his nephew, one of his mistress's sons. He adopted Octavian, this young man, before he died. An older teenager, quite frankly. And Octavian was sort of donned by Julius Caesar that to someday be the next Caesar. And not knowing that he was going to only reign for 4 or 5 years and then be assassinated, but Octavian took that very seriously. Nobody else took him seriously. He was a young boy compared to these generals and these senators and these people who ruled and had power and had whole armies at their command and that sort of thing. And here's this boy. But when Julius Caesar dies, there is civil war. There is no Caesar anymore. There's only the Senate and the army, and they can't agree what to do. And there's real dissension. So Brutus and Cassius, two of the senators, take a portion of the army, take control of it. Mark Antony, the greatest general in the Roman army, took control of about a third of the army. And this little boy, Octavian, took control of about a third of the army as well, because he had been donned by Julius Caesar to be the next Caesar. And there was enough people in the army that supported him that he was able to lead an army, but nobody took him seriously. The long and short of it is, he ended this guy named Octavian, this young boy donned to be Caesar, ended up defeating the senators who were leading a third of the army, and even Mark Antony, who was the most powerful and effective and successful general they had had in centuries. He was just very, very effective, had the loyalty of the army, very effective at war against other countries, and now then Octavian defeats him as well. Octavian does something very interesting. And that leads us to number three in letter A. That should be that Augustus Caesar reigned from 29 BC to 14 AD. And Octavian now then controls all the army because he has defeated the other two-thirds of the army. He goes into Rome. Can you imagine this? You're a senator in the city of Rome, and here comes this young man. He's a little bit older now. This has been a few years, so he's probably around 30-ish or early 30s at the latest at this point. But he comes into Rome, marches up to the Senate with the entire army behind him. He rides up to the steps of the Senate, gets off of his horse, gets off of his chariot, whatever he's in. He walks up the steps of the Senate, walks into the Senate. This is the guy who was the adopted son of Julius Caesar that they had assassinated. These men had done that. He now had the entire army outside the front door. What do you think he's going to do? What do you think they thought he was going to do? It was not going to be a pretty picture and in their minds. He walked in, and he basically looked at the Senate, and he said, I want to give the republic back to the people. I give you my power. I give you the army. I give you everything. I just want my seat on the Senate. That's all I want. Pretty bold move. Pretty unexpected move. And they are so overwhelmed by what he did. They said, no. We don't want all that. Okay, you can have your seat on the Senate, but you're going to be the first person in the Senate. You're going to be number one. He's called first citizen because, remember, it is controlled by the citizens. The Senate is only made up of representatives of the citizens, and they called him first citizen. So you're the first among equals. 3 days later, they gave him a new name, the August One, Augustus Caesar. The revered one. And it never stopped. They were so thankful for their lives and so thankful for that Augustus would come in and give them the republic back. They were on his side. And from that point forward, after that civil war, after Augustus does that, there were always three forces of power. And you're going to see this play itself out in the book of Acts. Over and over again, there were three axes of power in the Roman Empire after that. There was Caesar, there was the army, and there was the Senate. Over and over again, you're going to see those three axes of power. And the key to control, the power struggle that existed all the way through the book of Acts, all the way through the New Testament, was for two of those at least to be allied together. And where the two alliances, either it was the army and the Senate, or Caesar and the Senate, or Caesar and the army, whoever had the two-thirds majority, they're ultimately who controlled things. Okay? When the Senate and the army were united and Caesar was on the outs, you often saw Caesar get assassinated, eliminated, because they didn't like him. The thing about Augustus is, for the entire reign from 29 BC to 14 AD, that's a long time. From all that time, he had complete unity of all three, the Senate, the army, and himself as Caesar. All three of them worked together during that period of time. Now, Augustus Caesar, again, was the Caesar when Christ was born. It was Augustus who sent out the word for a census to be taken. And Joseph and Mary left their home up in Galilee and went down to Bethlehem to register at the command of Augustus Caesar, who controlled all of that Mediterranean area that we've looked at. He was that Caesar. He was probably then and probably up until today still the single most significant political figure that has ever lived that I can think of that has influenced the modern world as much as he has. I don't know of one other single solitary political figure who's ever influenced the world today as much as he did. Now, there were other people like Jesus who obviously had a greater influence and who were greater than Augustus Caesar, but I'm talking about a political figure for a lot of different reasons. He shaped the empire. The Romans were brilliant engineers. How was Augustus Caesar able to take all of the Mediterranean Sea in, for practical purposes, a relatively short period of time? 29 BC to 14 AD. We're looking at less than 35 years. He took all of that. How did he do that? I'll give you one example of their engineering abilities when it came to war and conquering. When they went into Germany, Germany said, look, you got all your army and all your abilities, all your weapons and everything else, but we got a river that you can't cross. And they destroyed all the bridges across the Rhine River so that the army of Rome could not cross. They said, it will take you at least a year, if not 2 years, to build bridges across so that you can get armies across. You can build something across and get a few people across, but you can't get armies across. 2 weeks later, the entire army of Rome crossed the Rhine River on some new invention called pontoon bridges that they invented on the spot. Never even thought about it before, but they invented them right there. And the entire army crossed, and Germany fell, even though it was a powerful and brutally powerful nation. They conquered them because they caught them by surprise, and their ingenuity gives you just one little sample of the ingenuity of these people and the power of Augustus behind them to go and do all of this stuff. They were a conquering machine during this time. So, one of the things that Augustus Caesar did was create a tremendous infrastructure. The whole Mediterranean Sea, for the first time in human history, they could sail the seas without piracy. He went in through his armies on the sea and got rid of all pirates. No piracy. So you could do trade and travel unencumbered. Didn't have to worry about it anymore. So trade just went up. You could travel. You were able to go from this country to that country across the Mediterranean. Because they were all a part of the Roman Empire, they could trade easily. You didn't have to basically get a visa every time you wanted to cross a border. You didn't have to go through all the paperwork and all the hassle and taxes and all. Didn't have to do that. So things were able to happen like they never had before. Built a highway all the way around the Mediterranean Sea so that if you didn't go by sea, you could go by land. There's a highway all the way around. Parts of that highway are still in existence today, and you can see it. You can walk on it. Even today, it was built out of stone and all the way around so people could travel. One of the things he did as well on page 3, the top of page 3, was the Pax Romana. The Roman peace was instituted. If you lived in the Roman Empire, there was a rule of law, and it was a rule of law with an iron fist. You abided by the rules of the Roman Empire or else. And there was no mercy. No mercy whatsoever. You abided by them. But what it did was provide this atmosphere where people could live securely, more secure than they ever had in history in that part of the world or any part of the world, because they lived under the provision and protection of Augustus Caesar and the army of Rome, which is the most powerful thing that had ever existed to that point in time. And the Roman Empire was spread throughout the empire, all over, and they enforced the law. You're going to see that in the book of Acts over and over again. You're going to see outposts of Rome in Corinth. You're going to see outposts of Rome in Philippi. You're going to see outposts of Rome in Ephesus. You're going to see outposts of Rome in Jerusalem, in Caesarea, all these different places, and they were there. They had large numbers of troops throughout the whole empire to maintain this Roman peace, this Pax Romana. It was something that was established by the political genius of Augustus Caesar. It was maintained by the power and the brutality of the Roman army. You stayed in line. Crucifixion was something that was introduced as part of the Roman peace. Well, that's interesting. We're going to have peace in the nation. What's one of the major things you're going to do? We're going to introduce crucifixion. Actually, crucifixion was something they borrowed. They tried to find the most severe form of death penalty they could, and they found it with the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians had practiced crucifixion, and they borrowed that, took that idea from them, and every major city would have one road into it and one road and in and out, major gate in and out, and they would line it with crosses. And the criminals who broke the Roman peace would be strung up on the cross, and as you entered the city, you had to walk through all these crosses and see Roman peace. What happened if you broke the peace? And as you left the city, you would be reminded again, if you come into this city and you break the law, we got a cross for you. Just want you to know. And there are people hanging there to let you know we mean it. Okay? So that's something that is going on during this period of time. It had some benefits. You think about everything I just talked about that Augustus Caesar has done, the sea that's going to come into effect with Paul and his ability to share the gospel all over the Roman Empire because of the ability for people to travel the sea. We're going to see the highway systems coming into play and the gospel being able to spread throughout the kingdom because they could go anywhere in the Roman Empire under the protection of the Roman Empire, of the army. They could go anywhere and they could take their message anywhere with them within the Roman Empire under the protection of Augustus Caesar and the Caesars later on after him and the Roman army. Okay, bottom of page 3, let me just hit a few things real quick. There were 4 Caesars that followed in the line of Augustus. There was Tiberius, a stepson of Augustus. He was not his choice, but it fell to him, and he was selected. He abdicated his responsibilities to the Praetorian Guard. Remember, Caesar, Praetorian Guard, and Senate, 3 axes of power. He abdicated to the Praetorian Guard, so he and the Praetorian Guard were together. So it provided him an element of protection and everything, but he was a worthless, self-indulgent, bitter Caesar. who cared nothing about the Roman Empire, only about himself. He's the one who appointed Pilate in Judea, that you will see in the book of Acts, and you will see throughout the New Testament and the Gospels. And he was the Caesar when Christ was crucified. Augustus, when Christ was born. Tiberius, when Christ was crucified. Caligula was the grandson of Augustus's daughter. He won favor with the people early, but he went insane, which was not unusual for some of these Caesars to do. But he went insane. Look at point three there. He erected a temple and statues to himself. He started his own religion, and his horse was the high priest. I kid you not. That's how insane this guy was. I mean, it was bizarre, but it gives you some idea of what was going on. He alienated the Romans and the Jews, and it was the beginning of something happening between the Romans and the Jews that just gets worse and worse and worse throughout the New Testament period. And we'll talk some more about that in just a second. Then we... Claudius, from 41 to 54, was the next emperor. He was a breath of fresh air for the Roman Empire, quite frankly. The first two were crazy, insane, self-indulgent individuals. But Claudius was very administratively minded. He continued to build the infrastructure that Augusta had started. But he picked up on that division between Romans and Jews and took it to an extreme. He hated Jewish people. And one of the reasons he hated Jewish people was because they believed in one God and one God only, and it wasn't Caesar. The Roman Empire was polytheistic, and we're going to look at that in a minute, but they believed in many gods, and they protected everyone's ability to worship many different gods. That was very important to them. And for these Jews to say, no, there's only one God, and it's none of yours, none of the gods you worship, and it's not Caesar, who was often worshiped as a god, then he hated them. He expelled them from Rome. And most of the Jews left the entire peninsula of Italy, and they were gone. You will see that, for instance, in Acts, it's going to be referred to in Acts 18 when you get there. A couple that Paul runs into were Roman citizens who had been expelled by Claudius. It's only 3 years before Paul writes the book of Romans, that Claudius dies and the Jews under Nero's reign are allowed to come back in. So there were no Jews in Rome most of the time when the early church was being established there. Interesting. It's not until 3 years before he writes his letter to the church at Rome. When you read the book of Romans, you will notice he writes to the Gentiles and he writes to the Jews. And back and forth, chapter 2, chapter 4, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, he's constantly speaking to them. Chapter 8, he gets into it a little bit. Chapters 9, 10, and 11, he's writing Jews, Gentiles, all the way, because they are living in that other part of town, in their own little settlement, and yet there's supposed to be one church in Rome all getting together, and yet historically there is this hatred between Jews and Romans in the city of Rome and in the Roman Empire. When you get to the settlement of the Macedonian call and Paul goes over to Philippi, you're going to notice that Paul on the Sabbath goes outside the city down by the river to see if he can find some worshipers of God. Why didn't he go to the synagogue like he always had every other time? Because there wasn't a synagogue in Philippi. because there weren't enough Jewish men to have a synagogue in Philippi. It took 10 Jewish men to have a synagogue. That means in the city of Philippi, part of the Roman Empire, there were not 10 Jewish men so that they could have a synagogue. Claudius has an impact empire-wide, and you're going to see that. Nero is the next. He is Claudius's adopted son, not Caligula's. He's Claudius's adopted son. He was really, about the first year, he was a pretty good emperor, and then he went insane, mainly because of fear. You have all the people wanting you to do everything they want you to do. You have to worry about the army. Am I in good favor with the Senate? Am I in good favor with the army? If I'm not, I'm going to die. They're going to kill me. I'm going to be assassinated. Some of his predecessors had been assassinated because they weren't in favor with both of those other groups or one of those other groups enough to save their life. Anyway, he goes absolutely berserk. In 64, into his reign, from 54 to 68, so 10 years into his reign, half of the city burns. And you'll see why in just a second, why that's so easy to happen. He did nothing. He did nothing to stop that. And after half the city burned, all these apartment buildings burned, where they were just densely packed in. They were landlocked because of how dense everything was. He, a few weeks later, comes out with architectural plans. Look, I have some things I want to build. How about that? I've got land to build it on now. And the citizens of Rome blame him for the fire. They claim that he set the city on fire so that he could build his buildings and all of that. And to get the heat off of himself, he blames Christians. And for the first time, by 64, Jews and Christians were clearly distinguished between. And he blames the Christians for setting the fires and begins to persecute them. That's in 64. Around 66, he kills the Apostle Paul. Around 68, he kills the Apostle Peter just before he commits suicide. So he begins a persecution during those last 4 years of his reign. There's a civil war on the next page for the next year and a half, 2 years. People are fed up with this. Well, just because you're related to Augustus, you're going to be the next Caesar. It wasn't working. Civil war takes place, four emperors in less than 2 years. A lot of killing going on of emperors. It wasn't healthy to be an emperor during that time. Finally, the kingdom is beginning, the empire is beginning to wither because of the civil war. And Vespasian, the general who had served on 8 different fronts in the Roman Empire, who had worked with a number of different armies, who was the commander of the entire Eastern Front, everything from Eastern Turkey, all of Israel, all the way into Arabia, all of that area was under his control. He was the general in charge of all of that Eastern Front. And in 69, he's called back by the Senate, there is no Caesar, to be the new Caesar. That's in 69. Something happens a year later. What's that? It's in 69 AD. What happens in 70 AD? Jerusalem is destroyed by a general named Titus, who just happens to be Vespasian's son. Vespasian's son takes over the Eastern Front as the general, and 1 year later, he just squashes Israel and the Israeli Jewish revolt that has been going on for a number of years now. You will see that evidenced as you get further into the book of Acts, and you see the focus coming back to Jerusalem for a period of time, you will see groups of people being talked about who were bandits, who were they were bombers. What do you call them? They put vests on today, and suicide bombers, terrorists. That stuff was going on. They didn't have bombs, but they had people who would walk into where there was a city official that they wanted to get rid of, or a religious figure that wasn't supporting the rebellion, and they would just walk in and kill them, knowing they were going to be killed on the spot. But they would kill that figure. And that was going on, Roman and Jewish officials alike. And it was just, there were zealots all around, and groups of zealots who were causing all kinds of problem for the army. And Titus just crushes it. Interesting thing. Realize that Titus, when he destroys Jerusalem, literally, it's right. When you go to Israel, you're going to see some of the destruction of Titus when he destroyed Jerusalem. You're going to see some of that. You're going to see some of the stones that were way up there that are down here now, and that sort of thing that he was responsible for. But he also took the wealth of Israel, mainly from Jerusalem, and he took between 50 and 70,000 Jewish slaves back to the city of Rome, and with it built the Colosseum and the Arch of Titus. And in the Arch of Titus today, in the city of Rome, is a large stone with a plaque on it that commemorates that event and talks about the Colosseum and this arch were built with the spoils from the city of Jerusalem. The same Colosseum that he would eventually, you would see Christians and Jews alike martyred in, was built with their money from their city. And then there's Domitian, and that's another, Titus eventually for a very short time becomes emperor, and then Domitian, the youngest brother of Titus, a son of Vespasian, he becomes, and he leads a greater persecution, an empire-wide persecution of Christians, and that he's the one who throws the Apostle John into, puts him on the Isle of Patmos and puts him in seclusion for the end of his days and everything. Most of John's writings were just before or during the reign of Vespasian. The Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, the Book of Revelation, most of his writings were during this period of Vespasian, of Domitian. Domitian, yeah, sorry. Okay. Let's look at some of the culture in the city of Rome itself, because it'll give you some idea of things that they were doing. You're going to see when you go to Israel, you're going to see some typical Roman cities from the time of the New Testament. And those Roman cities were modeled after the city of Rome. So let's look at what the city of Rome was like, and you'll see some of the same kinds of things in some of these Roman cities. You're not going to go to Rome, you're going to go to Israel, but they built Roman cities. Caesarea is one of them you're going to see. You're going to see another one to the east up in Galilee as well. A typical Roman city modeled after the city of Rome. So the city of Rome itself, it was the capital and the largest city in the empire. The Roman Empire never got over being a city-state, which revolved around the city of Rome. The Roman Empire did not exist for the benefit and the value of the people throughout the empire. For the elite, the aristocracy of Rome, The empire existed for the betterment of the city of Rome. That is so important to remember. Modern day Vatican City? The Vatican was built later on during the around 1500 or so AD with indulgences. It's one of the things Martin Luther posted his 95 theses about, was that they were collecting indulgences, and when they came through his city where he was a professor there at Wittenberg, they were scaring people, they were threatening people, and they had to buy indulgences to get their relatives out of purgatory to be able to go to heaven and everything. And they built the Vatican with those indulgences during that period of time. That was much later. Good question. It's really important to understand this, that the empire existed. Every Caesar needed to do things to show off his prowess, his ability, his power, his effectiveness as an emperor by building newer and bigger and better things in the city of Rome. Slaves would be brought back to the city of Rome. During this period of time, it was not uncommon for every middle-class family to have slaves in the city of Rome. It was a time of wealth, and everybody had a lot of stuff because they were bringing the stuff from the rest of the empire into the city of Rome to make the city of Rome bigger and better and nicer.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the distinction between slavery in the Roman Empire and slavery in the antebellum American South. A lot of times we backport what we know about American slavery into Rome, but there's some distinctions. If you could talk about that a little bit, that might be helpful.
I'll get there on the next page. Yep. Good question. Good comment. They had a lot of modern conveniences, running water, their aqueduct system, again, engineers. You go throughout the entire Mediterranean area and you will see aqueducts still standing today. You will, when you go to Caesarea in Israel, you will see to the north of coming down from the mountains, you will see an aqueduct, part of which is still there today, coming down to bring fresh water to the city of Caesarea. They built aqueducts all over, but there were a lot of modern conveniences. Sanitation. You can go to Ephesus today, and you can still see some of the sanitation, some of the sewer systems and drainage systems that were built in Ephesus during this period of time that are still functioning. In some parts of it are still functioning today. Unbelievable. Yeah, yes, you can. They had shopping centers, outdoor malls. They had areas where you could go and shop, very different from a lot of other places in the world. They had streets and highways as well, international travel. I've talked about all that. Their streets were wider than what I talked about last week. To you. Last week I said streets in ancient Mesopotamia were one ox cart wide. That's all the wider. And the houses were built up like this, two stories high, walled up, and an ox cart could get down the street. They had one-way streets. City of Rome, they were 12 feet wide. You could get two ox carts. You could get three ox carts down these. They were huge by comparison to a lot of ancient cities and everything. Plus, their highways were, for international travel, were unbelievable. Overpopulation, there were over 1 million people. I'm being conservative there. Again, some estimates are up to 2 million people living there. We don't know exactly. It sort of depends on the period. But somewhere between 1 and 2 million people. There were somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 private homes in the city of Rome. Somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500. These would mostly be one- and two-story, spread-out homes, very luxurious, very spacious homes that they would have. But there were 40,000. I did not misspeak. 40,000 high-rise apartment buildings that were one square block each. 40,000 of them that would go up no more than six stories high. All of them were four to six stories. You wanted to get as many as you could. They were built out of concrete walls. They didn't learn how to and learn the value of steel reinforcement like we have in concrete buildings today, but they had concrete. They couldn't take it more than six stories without it getting unstable. The way they used their concrete. The floors between all of them were wood. So you had wood floors. I wonder how you, when it gets cold, and it does get cold there in the wintertime, what do you do? Well, you start a fire. And you got wood floors. You got to be real careful not to let that fire get onto the wood floor, because the wood floor catches fire. It's going to spread to the wood floor above, and it's going to drop to the floors below and catch them on fire, and it's going to gut the entire thing. And they were like tinder boxes. They were like the how to start a very effective fire. That's what they were. So you can understand how half the city could burn in a matter of a few days with that kind of a setup. 40,000 square block buildings, six stories high, four to six stories high. The bottom floor would be the shops where you would work and have your shop, and people would come in and buy things often. You would do your trade often in those areas. And above is where the people would live. Often it would be an extended family that would live floor after floor after floor up above. Sometime they would rent them out if they were wealthy enough. They would put their slaves in there and have one whole floor just for their slaves to live on. Those kind of things. There were a lot of things that they did, but you can imagine going through a lot of the city of Rome, most of it six stories high, straight up, 12 feet between the buildings. That's how wide the roads were. 12 feet and you go up 50 feet.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are some things about that, but I haven't read a whole lot about it. I don't personally know that much about it during this period of time. It's a good question. You would imagine there would be, though. Would seem like it. Contrasting housing on the next page. I've already talked about that, the difference between those luxurious one-story, sometimes two-story, spread-out homes that were single family homes, and then all these apartment buildings that were built. There were class distinctions. There were the very poor and the very rich. But during the days of Paul, during the time of the New Testament, you see a growing middle class for the first time. Men were valued above women, but women seemed to have a way, depending on their status, family status, they could have a lot of power and influence depending on their money. Sometimes they got status and power that way. Sometimes it was by their family name or heritage that way. Slavery was on the rise. So I want to address Jeff's comment. It's a very good one. One thing you need to realize, at this point in the Roman Empire, approximately half of all the people who live in the Roman Empire during the days of Paul and the writing of most of our New Testament, nearly half or around half of the Roman Empire were slaves. One of the reasons that the Roman Empire eventually weakened and fell was because of that. You had such a large slavery population and everything. Now, Jeff is really right. The slaves were much different, though. We have records of slaves who served as lawyers, doctors, some public officials who would, and many times in Caesar's own household, his chief of staff sometimes was a slave. So they would bring in the best and the brightest quite often from these other countries and bring them in and make them their slaves and use their talents and gifts and abilities. They could earn money. They could work and improve their status. They could even get to the point of paying for citizenship as slaves. They had the ability, the opportunity to do those kinds of things. A citizen, any citizen had the right to free his slaves or her slaves if they wanted to. Any citizen had the right to confer freedom on their slaves. They could do that. And that was one way of getting citizenship. Another way was to buy your citizenship. A third way was to be born a citizen. That third way, being born a citizen, even though you were a citizen, it was considered the elite, the creme de la creme, the best of the best citizenship. Paul will use that as part of his defense. When you go later in the book of Acts, I was born, and he will face a Roman official who has arrested him who was not born a citizen. He's a citizen, but he wasn't born a citizen. And so Paul is saying, my citizenship is superior to your citizenship. If you're a citizen, I'm even more a citizen, kind of thing. Slaves were generally treated with respect, not always. It depended on the nature of the master. But you're going to see a lot of stuff in the New Testament about slavery. You can't read Paul's letters, very many of them, without you're going to have something about him speaking to masters and slaves and how they ought to relate with one another, or him writing to a master commending this slave to him and he needs to take him back and that sort of thing. You're going to see Paul writing about that. Half the Roman Empire were slaves, but they were generally treated with respect. There were masters of slaves who did not treat them well, but generally speaking, that was something that was encouraged and they wanted them to do. Any questions about that? Jeff, did I hit that?
No.
Do you have anything else about that?
Just in general, it's generally good for us to be careful that we don't read back our cultural experience into ancient history, so understanding the distinction. Obviously, slavery was still an abomination in many respects, even in that context.
Yep.
It wasn't the same. It wasn't race-based.
Mm-hmm.
It was one thing that's also interesting to point out. It was culturally based, right, but it wasn't race-based the way that American
Most slavery, I mean, there were indentured slaves, people who would make themselves slaves because they were in debt or something like that. But most of the slavery had to do with, they were captives of these countries that Rome had. You look at that Mediterranean basin, that all the way, that perimeter, all the way around, that in those 35 years that Augustus was Caesar alone, all of those countries were conquered and slaves brought back to Rome. All the people in those countries were slaves. They were owned by the Roman Empire, and they had to report to somebody. So that's where most of it came from. There was a moral decline that took place. Just these few states, the slaves that were brought to Rome created free time. So instead of people working as hard, they had their slaves work hard. Slaves were cheap to come by. Really, all you had to do was provide a food and shelter for them. That's all you really had to do if you were middle class. Many of them earned incomes and could get paid and all that as well. But for a lot of them, that they just didn't have to work as hard because they had slaves who could do it for them really cheap. So they had a lot of free time. The wealth that was brought to Rome created an entertainment society. On that front map, you might look back at it again, and you'll notice off to the left-hand side on the to the west is Nero's circus that was created. You have the Colosseum that was created, where they would have spectacles and events on a regular basis. There would be 100 days in a row where there would be some event in the Colosseum where the people could come in the city of Rome to be entertained. 100 days of vacation. Okay? Huh? That's a vacation. And every day there was something going on in the Colosseum to entertain the citizens of Rome. Gives you some idea of what was going on. What that led to was a lewd, self-indulgent culture. Pornography, prostitution, adultery were rampant in the city of Rome and in the Roman Empire. Education, you can just read what's there. Most teachers were slaves, and most of them were Greek. Remember we talked early on about Macedonia and Greece was one of those countries that had attacked Rome and been conquered by Rome, and they took the educated from Greece and brought them back, and constantly were bringing Greek people in to be teachers. Most of the aristocracy of Rome were taught by Greeks. Have you ever wondered why Greek was the language of the Roman Empire instead of Latin? It's because that was the language of the education and of the educated. And so that's what they took throughout the Roman Empire as well. Family life, monogamy was generally practiced, one marriage at a time, but there were a lot of marriages, it was not uncommon, and it was very accepted to divorce and remarry for status purposes. If I could get rid of this person and marry this person and move up the social ladder of status, that was considered a wise move in their culture. When Augustus comes in, though, marriage and family had really degenerated a lot, and he instituted a lot of new laws that made it very advantageous to get married, to be married, and to have children. He made it disadvantageous. It cost you. You got taxed heavily if you did not get married by a certain age and if you did not have a certain number of children by a certain age. He wanted to build the especially the aristocracy, the core of the empire. He wanted to build that, and that was part of what he did. Let's talk about religion for just a second. Uh-huh. Well, yeah, that's reading, writing, and arithmetic, okay?
you pointed this out before when we talked about this, that idea of the taxes, if you're not married by a certain age, you don't have children by a certain age. Just think of that in the context of Paul saying it's better for people not to marry and remain as I am. We kind of think about that and say, what? Like, that really doesn't fit for us. Now think about that in that context of that culture. What is he asking people to do? What's the cultural price and the economic price? Who's going to hit their wallet?
Yeah.
Right? So that kind of opens that up for you a little bit when you read things like that.
Yeah. You can go back and listen to a message on 1 Corinthians 7 that gets into all that. Yeah. Religion. Three things. Polytheism. They were very concerned that every god get recognized, because if they leave out a god, that god may get mad at them. Okay? So that was sort of the Roman mentality. So as they would conquer a country that worshiped different gods, they would incorporate those gods and make that part of the Roman Empire. And they, of all the things they did, they took everything back to Rome, but they made sure that the temples, the holy places of these countries were protected. So the Roman Empire would protect these pagan places of worship. They would make sure they were protected. They were taken care of. The only reason that any city or country could practice capital punishment in the Roman Empire, apart from Rome declaring death for someone, the only way that a local community or a state could give the death sentence was if someone desecrated their holy place. Now think about that when you get to the end of the book of Acts, near the end of the book of Acts, and Paul goes to the temple, and what do they charge him? What do the Jews charge him with? They charge him with desecrating the temple. Because that's the only way the Jewish people had the right in the Roman Empire to kill him. And they were ready to do it on the spot. And if they had, they likely would have gotten away with it. And everything. But that's the only thing that they could do. They protected that. Now, polytheism was so important. The gods were so important. Think about, why is it that Jews and Christians irked the Romans so bad? One God. That means they worshiped all these other gods. And as the Roman Empire progressed along from the days of Julius Caesar, when Augustus took power, he declared Julius Caesar a god and sent a bust of Julius Caesar, a bust of him throughout the kingdom. To every city had a bust of Julius Caesar, and he was one of their gods that they ought to worship. And from that point forward, every Caesar was looked at as a god and was to be worshiped, and he was the chief god. By the time you get to Domitian at the end of the New Testament era, during the life of John, he declared himself to be God, and he was not just the chief God, he demanded that everyone worship him and him alone. And that was a first in the Roman Empire. And that's why the persecution of Jews and Christians during that time just escalated so much throughout the entire empire. They were not willing to worship anyone except the one true God. So polytheism was a big part of all of that. The Jews, later after Claudius, there's a sizable group of Jews that come back to Rome. It was the New York City of that day. I mean, it was the merchant capital of the world. if you wanted to be in business and do trade, that was the place in any place in the world. They went back there. And so there are a lot of Jewish people who went back, partly because many of them, that was their home. That's, they had been kicked out by Claudius. Now they're going back home. But they lost their homes. They lost anything they couldn't carry with them when they left. And that's why they settled in that settlement across the river. And they were delegated, relegated. That's where you're going to go. That's where you can live at that point in time, which made it very difficult when you get to the book of Romans for the Gentile Christians and the Jewish Christians who came back, who had come become Christians before they came back. It made it very difficult for them to mesh together. Very challenging. How am I doing here? And Christianity, the last thing. Christians and Jews were often lumped together, but by 64 AD, we know that they weren't, because Nero's charge was that Christians, not monotheists or not Jews and Christians, created the fire. It was beginning to grow rapidly in Rome. You're going to see in the book of Philippi that he was Christianity was having an effect even in Nero's house, his household. There were people within the Praetorian Guard in Rome, people who were within Caesar's household coming to know the Lord during this period of time. Okay, my time is up.
Okay.
On the button. So.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Greg.
You're welcome.
Any final questions before we call it a morning?
Can we go to Rome too?
Yeah, I know.
I'm sorry?
Hang on one sec, guys. Got a question?
He didn't do anything in the temple that would have desecrated it. And they didn't have, they knew they didn't have the right to kill Jesus. That's why they appealed to the Roman authorities, people in charge, to do that for them when it comes to Jesus. He had not done anything that gave them the right to kill him. And they knew that. Paul, on the other hand, they charged him with that, even though he hadn't done that. It would depend on the religion, you know, what desecration would be. And so.
Which is interesting to think, too, that the Romans were willing to desecrate the Jewish temple. And I wonder if that's specifically because they hated their monotheism so much that it finally culminated and they went total opposite of what they would have done for other cultures.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So real quick, homework. Thank you. I'll swipe that from you.
Okay.
All right, real quick, homework. Next week, come ready to teach, okay? Now, here's what I mean by that. You've gotten a lot of tools, and we've got historical context that Rick's given us and that we've talked a lot about. You've got interpretive tools. Remember observation, interpretation, application, right? Remember context, history, and genre. Use all the tools we've talked about, the themes of Scripture, the primary stories that weave throughout the Old and New Testaments. Hopefully these things are all ringing bells in your mind. It's right. This is all stuff we're starting to remember now. So what I want you to do for next week is this. We're studying Acts chapter 13 and Acts chapter 14 next week. And we're going to kind of start transitioning. So I'm not just going to throw you guys the wolves and say it's all you. We're going to do it together. So I'll still be prepping to teach as well. But here's what I want you to be ready to do. Okay. First, identify the major sections, the breaking points in those chapters. Are there different stories? Are there different things going on? Are there portions that stand alone? Or is the whole 13 and 14 a unit that goes together? And if that's what you decide, that's fine, okay?
I want you to at least come with three major points of observation for each of those sections. You may decide it's all one thing that goes together. You may decide they're separate sections. But for whatever you decide, three major points of observation. That's asking who, what, when, where. Then the question is why? That's the interpretive question. So I want you to do your best using the tools you have to interpret the text. Why does Luke write this story? Why does he write it at this time? Why does he write it in this way? What questions is Luke trying to answer? Okay? What would an original reader of this have been asking that Luke is trying to answer in this text? And then finally, for each of those sections, try to come up with an application point. So do the good work of observation, asking those questions of what do I see? Then do the work of asking the questions, why is this here? Why does Luke say this? How would an original hearer have heard it? Now what? How do we take that interpretation and apply it to our day and our context? Okay? So three observation points per section, one interpretation per section, and an application. There could be multiple, but just one application will be fine for each section. And that will hopefully give you an arsenal of stuff to talk. And then I'm going to ask that everybody talks at least once next week. So come ready to interact and share, and we'll go from there. Cool? All right. Thanks, guys. See you next week.